It's my pleasure this morning to introduce Dr. William Cole Brenner, who's a senior lecturer in English literature at Bar-Ilan University. It's very hard to encapsulate, really, Dr. Cole Brenner's work, which I've read for years, and I had the pleasure of hearing him speak on Shabbat. The best way of putting it, really, is that he's a remarkably engaged mind. He's a person who is able to synthesize an enormous amount of material from both the Western tradition and the Jewish tradition and put them together in conversation that, in my experience, is certainly unique. He's officially, he's an international authority on the works of John Milton. He's published on Milton and is now working on a book in progress called From Athens to Jerusalem, which is a discussion of exactly those themes, a synthesis of how we go about thinking about the Western, the Greek, and the Jewish traditions. In addition, however, Dr. Cole Brenner has taken an interest in special needs children. He'll tell you why. And the topic of this morning's talk is, in fact, God's pattern, loving and living with a special needs child. Please welcome Dr. William Cole Brenner.
Thank you very much for that very, very generous introduction. And I hope I can live up to it. I have some handouts maybe Dr. Mullinet can help with. Thank you. I'm going to talk straight into the microphone. Okay. My hope is that you're going to be able to hear me without me talking straight into the microphone, and the microphone will communicate to whatever machines are recording me. So, I am a university professor, but and I know this is a conference, which makes it sound so fancy and academic, doesn't it? I was very impressed by that. We usually don't have conferences like this. This is probably going to be less of a paper and more of a presentation, even though it's so early in the morning. Presentation means I get to ask you questions. I get out of my academic paper mode, so I hope we'll cooperate together. So just to start out, here's a hypothetical for you. It's a little bit different, I think, in Toronto than in Yerushalayim, but you'll go with me for a minute. In my building in Yerushalayim, it's the kids who supply all the news. And if anything happens in the neighborhood, the first people who register the fact that something indeed has happened are the children. So let's say there's a call. Something's going on. One of the neighbors, it's turned out, has had a baby. Mazel tov. Yeah? But then the normal frequency that's broadcasting tends to be registering something out of the ordinary. And the kids aren't explicit about it, but something has happened. So you find out that the next door neighbor, they have had a baby. But, I don't know, is that the right word? The baby was born with Down syndrome. So what do? That was the question. I guess some people don't need their coffee in the morning. You're much faster than I am. So the question is, do you go over and wish them a mazel tov? Absolutely. Any dissenting opinions? I'm not saying, at least not yet, that there's a right or a wrong answer, but I'd be interested in just exploring the possibilities. Yeah.
I would. I'm not sure if I would say exactly mazel tov, but I'd be feeling that, and maybe just be more interested in seeing where the parents were at, because some parents are more, some are less in a position to feel whatever they might feel about it.
Uh-huh. So you would say you really have to be receptive to what's going on. Anybody say you don't wish a mazel tov? When my baby was born, Shmuel was born 5 years ago, two of my rebbeim came to the hospital and in front of me conducted an argument about whether or not to say Mazel Tov or not. I think probably the right answer really is, I don't know, Rabbi Kelman, what would you say? I think probably the right answer is Mazel Tov. Mazel Tov. Because the alternative, what's the alternative? It really leaves people in isolation. What I'd like to ask today, though, really, is how do we react to a special child? What are our own reactions? When Shmuel was born, it was really the opportunity in my community for many people, for better or for worse, when something like this happens. Elliot and I were talking in the car, and he suggested to me that sometimes the best response, aside from the conventional, is silence. But when you have when something happens to you, where a special child is born into your household, sometimes you get lots and lots of advice. So I heard lots and lots of advice. It's taken me about 5 years of time for me to process that advice, and that's why I'm here today in front of you. After the 5 years of processing, I finally thought things through. So one Rav in my neighborhood told me that the birth of a special child, and this is a person I admire, all of these people who I'll tell you about are people I admire. The birth of a special child, they said, is a manifestation of pure din. What's din? Judgment. Divine judgment. Think that's the case? Well, you know, you should talk to my wife. I mean, she's Schlatz Shmuel to occupational therapy, to speech therapy, to this special school. So it's not so simple. On the other hand, I heard a story that was recounted to me of a father who also had a child who was born with Down syndrome years earlier. And at the bris, he stood up and said, Hodul Hashem, praise be to God. This is a manifestation of pure rachamim, of pure mercy. So which one is it? Is it rachamim or is it din? Is it judgment or is it mercy? Which category does Shmuel fall into? Which box would we put him into? Yeah? Yeah. Yeah. As I said, you know, when Shmuel was born as well, we got lots of advice. Somebody, one of our friends, came to the hospital who worked there, and she said, you know, don't worry about it. We can take Shmuel away. We'll foster him. So normally at Shaarei Tzedek Hospital, where my children were born, they rush you out of the hospital. I mean, they insist that you stay for 3 days. Now, my wife always wants to come home for Shabbos. So with all my other kids, they're like, sorry, Mrs. Colburn, you have to stay. When the hospital nurses found out that we actually wanted to keep Shmuel, they said, go right ahead, right? They showed us the door. So what is it about a special child? And I guess in general, a more general question I want to ask is, which category do they fit in? And more generally, how atypical or how special are our special children? How do we relate to our special children in our own families? Do we look at them differently than we look at other children? Try to treat them the same. Yeah. So I'll ask you one other question. The gentleman just said that Din and Rachamim are why it happened. This thing happened to me very recently. I was in Simchas Torah in my shul in Israel, in Yerushalayim, with my kids, my two youngest kids. First, my youngest son, who's 2.5, Pinchas, and then my son Shmuel, who's 5, and we were dancing around the Torah. And we came around to the rabbi who was sitting in the front, and it's the same rabbi, the Din rabbi. He shook my hand, looks me in the eye, and he says, everybody has to suffer. I'm like, whoa. Simchas Torah, Rabbi. This is not cynicism. Everybody, I think, in all the stories that I'll tell you, are extremely well-intentioned. Perhaps I was communicating something that he picked up on. I don't know. I don't think that I was. But he looked at me and he said, everybody has to suffer. So I asked another friend of mine who's a rabbi in a shul, Rabbi Kelman, what would you have done in a similar situation? You would go to a different shul. I'm not asking you. Rabbi Kelman said that he would go to a different shul. I'm not asking you. I'm not. Okay, we can talk later. No, I was asking you you're identifying with my perspective. I was identifying you from the rabbinical point of view.
The exact question is, you were just saying you were your destiny.
Yeah. Right. So I was at a seminary. We're making this poor fellow in the back run around with a microphone. I'm sorry. Rabbi Kelman said, you were dancing. I was at a seminary, and I was preparing to give a version of this talk, and one of the girls at the seminar in Yerushalayim had made a collage of sayings, and one of the sayings was, it is an obligation to see properly. We have an obligation to open our eyes. So I was thinking to myself, how many mitzvahs are there? How many commandments are there? 613. I'll have to ask rhetorical questions to get out of the microphone problem. There are 613 commandments. Which number is we have an obligation to open our eyes? Which one does that fit in? I asked the girls. We can make up mitzvahs? Akiva, is there a special mitzvah to open up your eyes? Not that we know of. So it may be that opening up our eyes is a necessary prerequisite for performing any of the mitzvahs. So going back to the question that I asked Rabbi Kelman, I would have thought, what should he do? What should he have done, this Rav? Look at my son's face. He's bouncing off the walls, right? My wife says to me, children with Down syndrome, depending upon the variation, have an extra chromosome. So my wife sometimes looks at me despairingly and says, Bill, I wish sometimes that you had an extra chromosome. Shmuel is a very cheerful child. I don't know. So, I mean, what should the Rav have done? Open your eyes and see. So all of these questions that I really want to ask, what is the right response to say a mazel tov or not say a mazel tov? I think really, as Rabbi Kelman says, you got to say it. How do we look at a child with Down syndrome? Din or rachamim, which one is it?
Neither?
Oh, come on. We're Jews. We have to think in terms of categories, don't we? We're briskers. We think of things in... Everything's got to be in a box, no? Isn't that the case? The Torah, after all, gives us a blueprint, a way of looking at the world. I want to know... I'm sure Rabbi Kelman, you must have learned with the Rav, yes? Or the Rav's Torah. Everything... Kadosh Baruch Hu gave us a blueprint for reality. I want to know, where does it fit? Where does this particular experience fit? And for that matter, where do my other children fit? Yes? Okay, so maybe we'll... somebody suggesting derech hayasher, sensitivity. We have another mitzvah. Maybe that's combined with an order actually to be sensitive, you might say. The prerequisite is opening one's eyes. As an English professor, or somebody who studies and loves literature, there are turning points in many of the great works of literature are these moments of what Aristotle calls anagnorisis, or recognition. What happens in King Lear? Lear sees Gloucester. Lear sees Cordelia. In the Odyssey, when Odysseus comes home and he's recognized. All these great works of literature, what do? They thematize or they emphasize the importance of sight or seeing. From sight comes insight. From sight, maybe as you're suggesting, comes sensitivity. Before the possibility of sensitivity, there has to be vision. You have to turn and look. There's an obligation to turn around and look. This face is calling me. I'd really like to think about this talk today as maybe dovetailing with some of the issues that were raised yesterday. In a way, a child that is quote-unquote off the derech is also a special child. What are our obligations to special children? Is there a continuum of special children? When we look at them, do we say, din? Or do we say rachamim? Yes? It's second guessing the Almighty, or just giving a kind of commentary or perush.
Whatever it is, I think we have to say, this is my child.
So what's being suggested is, instead of second guessing, as you say, we need to engage. That's not our business. It's interesting. Our business is not the employing of categories. Our business is seeing and looking. Maybe we'll get back to, but maybe we'll explore that a little bit further. Yes. So that's a difficult thing. Everybody has to struggle, maybe even suffer, and a person has to grow in a chanami, challenge, in a sion. Please.
And to say, thank God, we have changed. Our last was changed 25 years ago from the closet.
Okay.
You're praying with the prayer of Shida. Today, thank God, there's enough
Sir Rabbi Kalman, you're coming. I think all of the comments are coming from a certain level of maturity, which I really respect. I don't think when my Shmuel was born, I wasn't coming from that level. I really wasn't. So I think the madrego, or the level of acceptance that many of you, I no doubt, have, and I think Rabbi Kalman, from what I understand, has it from a long experience clinically or as an educator. It's hard won. That sensitivity is hard won. I'd like to move a little bit from the anecdotal just to some texts. Can we do that? Is that okay? Yeah? That will. So those are the texts that we have in front of you. And I want to think about issues of difference. All great thinkers are interested in the relationship between conceptions of similarity and difference. Francis Bacon says there are two kinds of people in this world. There are kinds of people who look at difference and kind of people who see similarities. Which one are you? Bacon doesn't mean that. He means there are two ways of looking at the world. We see things either through difference or similarity. So instead of looking, lahavdil lo lahavdolus, at Francis Bacon, don't think that the lahavdil is suggesting that I don't love Francis Bacon. I do, right? But still, it's a real lahavdil. Yeah? So we'll talk about difference in the image of God. I guess I'll read, since we don't want to fool around with the microphone. Perhaps we'll do that later. Hu haya Omer from Perki Avos. Choviv Adam Shenivra B'Tselem. Chiba Yisera Nodeslo Shenivra B'Tselem. So it says, Rabbi Kiva used to say in Perki Avos, beloved is the man who is created in his image. And even more so that he was informed that he was created in such an image. Then it brings a proof text. I won't go into the proof text at the moment. What is the Chavivos? The endearing aspect of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. What's being emphasized in this particular Mishnah? Choviv Adam Shenivra B'Tselem. What's being emphasized here? Similarity or difference? Obviously. So what underlies our relationship to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and Hashem, and God informs us of this, is a fundamental similarity between man and the Creator. That is, all the other creatures, as we'll see, perhaps don't have exactly this kind of relationship. Only of Adam do we say is he created, B'Tselem Elohim. Say, Gemara in Sanhedrin, which we'll turn to. Maybe we'll look right at the English in the interest of time, and first we'll go to the Hebrew selectively. And to proclaim the greatness of Hashem, when a man mints coins with one stamp, we're in the metaphor of somebody who's minting, right? A money, somebody, I guess, for like a government. What's the right word for that? A mint, yeah? All are similar to each other. But when the King of Kings mints each man from the stamp of Adam HaRishon, each one of them is different. The fichach, therefore, kol echod ve'echod chayev lomar b'shvili nivra ha'olam. Wow. Therefore, it's an interesting therefore, no? It is incumbent upon each person to say, for me, the world was created. Now this passage is a little bit more complicated. Mishnah Perkei Avos is obvious. What's being emphasized? Similarity. What about this passage? What's getting emphasized here? Pardon? Individuality? Where do you see that? When a man mints coins with one stamp, all are similar to each other. However, but when the King of Kings mints each man from the stamp of Adam Arishon, each one of them is different. Ah, is this passage only emphasizing the difference? So certainly we see on the pashtus, on the simple level, there is this emphasis on difference. Everybody's different. So that might license some sense of total difference. Are we in the realm of total difference, or is there a similarity also sneaking in here and underlying it? What do you say, Akiva?
I think that it's truly looking for a happy medium. We have a genuine connection as to our race and our humanity.
So Akiva is saying, very good here, right? Akiva is saying, on the one hand, the passage is emphasizing difference. On the other, Adam Arishon. What's Adam Arishon's relationship to HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Selam Elokim. So even though there is this manifestation of difference, and everybody is different, nonetheless that there is this underlying similarity. Everybody is created from Adam Arishon, so that difference then gets assimilated back to Adam Arishon. And then from Adam Arishon we see not difference, but rather similarity in relationship to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So even though we're all different, there is nonetheless that common denominator. This comes out very interestingly in Hilchos Brachos, in the halachas of saying brachos and blessings. One of the things that's fascinating about beginning to learn halacha is it doesn't necessarily have to be dry. Implicit in halacha, in Jewish law, can be a whole worldview. So we'll see in this halacha of the Rambam, you'll see a whole worldview implicit here. The Rambam is saying, I see extraordinary things, things that I've never seen before. I haven't seen in my country, in my nation. I see a person, this is in the Hebrew, Haroa, Sakushi, Vesamashunin, a different kind of person, somebody who has a face that I've never seen before. His limbs aren't the same as I'd normally see. You say, Baruch Ato Hashem, Elokeinu Melech Olam, Meshana Es Habris. Blessed are you, Hashem, who changes or varies the creation. The Rambam continues. Haroa Suma. What's a Suma? A blind person, or Kita, I guess somebody who is handicapped. Umuchashkin, a very, very ugly person. It means probably some kind of birth defect. Ubakinyan, Ukiyotzeben. So these other things. Mivarech, Baruch Ato Hashem, Elokeinu Melech Olam, Dayan Ha'emes. So the different kinds of brachas. This particular distinction between, let's say, seeing a summa, somebody who has an inherent disability, and the others, I'm not so interested at the moment, but I am interested in the continuation. The very, very end, after the comma, haro es hapil, what's a pil? An elephant. Ves hakof, a monkey. Ves hakifuf, your guess is as good as mine, I'm guessing. Chimpanzee, I don't know. Armar, baruch, mishana, Es Habrios. So we see three brachas. I'm not so interested in the moment in the distinction between the first two, but rather in the distinction between the first two as a set and the last one. You hear the question? Hello? Knock, knock, knock. You hear the question? The first two as a set. The Rambam is not abbreviating. He's not being makatzer. He's giving you the full brachas. What's the difference between the first two and the last one? When I see people who manifest certain kinds of difference, I say one set of brachas. When I see animals, I never saw that before, right? It's not my concern at the moment. I mean, I think there's a lot to be said about it. I think one probably has to do with things that happen, I prefer not to explore that at the moment. I'm really interested in exploring, which is not to say it's not an excellent question, the relationship between the first two and the third. What's the significant variation or difference? That's what they taught me in graduate school in English. Okay, I'm asking about the quality of the bracha. Yes. There's no Shem Hashem. There's no mention, as has been said, of the Shem Hashem. The last bracha reads, Baruch Ata, Baruch Mishana Es Habrios. Blessed are you who changes or varies the creation. When we turn our attention to the animals, what gets absented? Tzelem Elohim, is that fundamental thing that links all people back to God, is not present by animals. So no matter what the differences are, and they are manifold, nonetheless, that difference is underlied by a common similarity. What is that similarity? Tzelem Elohim. So when we open our eyes or prepare to look at difference, we look at difference, and in that difference, or maybe through that difference, or I would even suggest to you perhaps more radically, because of that difference, we see Tzelem Elohim. That is, difference is the means through which Tzelem Elohim becomes present to us. So the Rambam formulates this perspective in Halacha. I'd like, if we can, to look at the next sets of passages from Moshe Rabbeinu, from Shmot, or about Moshe Rabbeinu, actually from Bamidbar, from Numbers. Chumash provides many, many examples of parenting. But instead of, I want to do something a little bit perhaps out of the ordinary, and instead of looking at those passages explicitly about parenting, I'd like to look at those passages about leadership. Is there a relationship between a good leader and a good parent? Okay, kids, get in the car. Right? Or try doing that at 7:30 in the morning with 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 or 7. Right? It ain't easy. You got to be a good leader, right? Every morning can be, a military operation. I'm serious. Is there a relationship between a good parent and a good leader? What is the characteristic of a good leader? And is there a relationship between the characteristics of good leaders and a good parent? So we see in the psukim that follow, perhaps we'll find some direction. So Pasuk says, Tezayin Yivchod Hashem Elokei Haruchos. Hashem is understood. How do we translate that? Elokei Haruchot. L'chol basar ish al ha'edo. We know that Moshe Rabbeinu is preparing for his own demise, and he has to find a new leader. He calls Hashem Elokei Haruchot. Let's look at the English. And Moses spoke unto the Lord, saying, Let the Lord, the God of the spirits of all flesh, set a man over the congregation, Elokei Haruchot, the spirit of all flesh, which may go out before them, and which may go in before them, and which may lead them out, and which may bring them in, that the congregation of the Lord be not as sheep with no shepherd. That is, everybody needs a leader. So how do we understand this pasuk, or this verse, that's of Elokei Haruchot? What does that mean for us? So Rashi says, just want to make sure we have the same on the same page. Yeah, Rashi says, Elokei Haruchot, Lama ne'amar amar lefanav Rebbeinu shel olam gilo v'yadu lefanecha, it's known before you, Dato shel kol echad ve'echad, and ve'eino domin ze leze. Mano olehem manhig shehi sovel kol echad ve'echad lefi dato. Why does the Kaddish Baruch Hu, why does Moshe Rabbeinu call him Elokei Haruchot? Why? We should do that in English, right? You know the dot of every person. Call echod the echod. Ve'eino doimin ze leze. Everybody is different. So therefore, Moshe Rabbeinu is eminently logical. Mona aleihem, appoint for them. A manhig, she so will call echod the echod lefi dato. So what's his advice? Appoint somebody. What does the word sovel mean here? Tolerant. So it can mean tolerant. Pardon? To be, I think it literally it means, or we would say, to be sovel means to carry or to be tolerant. Pardon? To forbear probably would be a good translation. That is, a good leader, perhaps also like a good parent, has to know the relationship, or has to know the das, or dot, of all the people for whom he is responsible, or for whom she is responsible. So Moshe Rabbeinu says, everybody's different. You have to find a manhig who is going to be able to accommodate that difference. Without that accommodation, without that kind of understanding of difference, there's really no possibility of being a good leader. So what is the prerequisite then of finding somebody like that? Who fits the bill? Who fits the bill who knows the das of everybody in their nation? What's the prerequisite? Ah, that he sees. Good. Let's turn to page 2, the section called Seeing and Salvation. Psukim say, this is the beginning of Exodus. V'yishma Elohim es nakosim, v'yizkor Elohim es briso es Avraham, es Yitzchak, v'yiz Yaakov, v'yir Elohim es b'nei Yisrael, v'yado Elohim. And God heard the cries, and God remembered the covenant of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and God saw b'nei Yisrael, and he knew them. What's the process here? What's going on in these two verses? God heard the cries and remembered the covenant of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and God saw B'nai Israel, and he knew them. What comes first? So first we see what's necessary is HaKadosh Baruch Hu hears, Kuviyachol, and sees, and then he knows. That is the prerequisite for knowledge is sight. If you don't look at a person, if you don't hear a person, can you know them? Can you? This is not a marriage seminar, but it could, right? I mean, you know, it's always somebody saying, he's not, don't you see me? Aren't you listening to me? So Kadosh Baruch Hu is a good listener. He hears and he sees and then he knows. So the prerequisite for knowledge is sight. We see in a kind of anticipation of this that it's not only a Kadosh Baruch Hu in Chumash who is able to manifest this quality of perception of sight, but it's also Moshe Rabbeinu. The Torah is very, very mekatzer. It shortens things. We don't get life and times in a very fully articulated way. We get short stories. Look at this pasuk that follows. This is in Shmos Perek Bet. V'hiba b'yomim ahem, in those days, v'yigdal Moshe, v'yetzel achav, v'yiro b'siv lasom. It's amazing how much gets compressed into one verse. Let's take it a step at a time. V'hiba yomim ahem, v'yigdal Moshe. What period of Moshe's life is being described here? Adolescence. Moshe's coming of age, right? Here the Torah is describing the coming of age of Moshe. And what characterizes that coming of age? V'yetze al achav. He goes out to relate to his brothers. And next? V'yira b'sivlosam. He sees their suffering. That is, Moshe's coming of age, Moshe Rabbeinu's coming of age is characterized by going out to his brothers, opening his eyes, and looking, seeing. That's the prerequisite to see the other. This notion, this thematic emphasis upon sight, is further emphasized in a beautiful medrash on the pasuk in Perek Gimel. First, the pasuk, this is on the top, or this is on the bottom of your page 2. Or at the top of your page 3, I'm sorry. V'yira Elohim, ki sar liros, v'yikra alav Elohim mitoch hasne. What's happening in this pasuk? I just want background, right? You know, like v'yira Elohim. What's the narrative context here? Moshe is looking for his lost sheep, and what does he come upon? The burning bush. So now we'll go back to the pasuk. V'yira Elohim kisar liros. In the Pashtus, what is Moshe Rabbeinu looking at? He's looking at the bush, right? Notice how the Chazal, Darshan, or homiletically explain what's happening. Let's look right at the English. God said, you put aside your own concerns and went to see the sufferings of Israel. You turned away from your own business affairs, v'sar lirot. You turned to see. Because Moshe turned to see, God saw in Moses that he turned from his own concerns to see their sufferings. Therefore, he called to him from the bush. That is, the Medrash is making a connection. What is the connection between? There are two turnings here. What are the two turnings? Moshe turned to Klal Yisrael to see their sufferings. Rashi says, seeing their sufferings is a kind of empathy. Opening up your eyes, not hiding your face, looking, not only sympathizing, empathizing with the other. Moshe Rabbeinu evidenced that ability to sympathize, to empathize. Again, what's the prerequisite for that? You called it before sensitivity. What's the prerequisite for that? You have a chiyuv to open your eyes and see and to look. Is it easy to see and to look? Is it? The short answer, the quick answer, before you catch yourself is, oh yeah, sure. But what happens all the time? Catch yourself not seeing, right? We have blind spots. The person who says the most quickly, I see that, probably is likely that they're missing something. I mean, we're always missing something. But Moshe Rabbeinu evidences this very strong impulse to turn and to see. And because of that, what happens? God turns towards him. So there's a connection. If we just extrapolate a little bit further, what is sight connected to in this Medrash? What is this Medrash associating with sight? The ability to open one's eyes. When I do that, what happens? Fine. I'm asking now from a Kadosh Baruch Hu side. What gets added? When I see others, the Shekhinah comes down, right? God's divine presence comes down. When you see others, that's when HaKadosh Baruch Hu makes himself present. Through that sight, through that activity, Moshe Rabbeinu turns to see. Because of that, he merits the divine presence. It's an astonishing thing, isn't it? Astonishing. It's really a microcosm for many things we see in Yiddishkeit, right? We don't have abstract ideas of spirituality. Spirituality is embodied. It comes into the world. How can I bring it into the world? Open my eyes. Look. See. Lots of sources. Can I tell a story? Yeah. Just about sight. We're talking before about the bad advice I got when my son Shmuel was born. So here's one. So we got out of the hospital, and somebody in the hospital told us, don't tell the children, right? Don't tell the kids. At the time, I had five other kids, Kinahara, right? Don't tell them. They'll get used to the idea. After 6 months, you'll tell them, right? So my wife and a person in that kind of situation is extremely vulnerable. And that's why I think shtika, silence, support is one thing, as you all said at the beginning. Support, mazel tov, how can I help? Can I bring food? But advice, there's a certain kind of restraint that's perhaps advisable. Anyway, don't tell the children. Okay, we're not going to tell the children. So we get home, my wife's in bed with the baby, my oldest daughter, Elisheva, must have been about 13 at the time. So we're all in the bedroom surrounding the new baby. Of course, the baby's enormous excitement in the family. So the Sheva takes a look at Shmuel and she says, he has Down syndrome. Okay. Okay. Yeah, okay. So she runs out of the house. So my wife and I, she's the oldest child, has enormous responsibility because the response of the oldest child tends to be the lens through which the other children look at things. 15 minutes. My daughter is not, Elisheva is very restrained. She's not overtly the nurturing type. She comes back in after 15 minutes, picks up Shmuel, gives him a big hug, grabs him, takes him to the neighbor's house. Right? Amazing. My daughter, Avital, she was 8 at the time. So she looks at me, different sensibility. She says, Abba, what's Down syndrome? So I run downstairs to my office, you know, Google Down syndrome, right? Trying to find out, you know, some basic stuff that I can tell her. So I tell her, I had already done that. So I tell her the best I can what Down syndrome is, at least what I understood at the time. She nods, thinks a bit. She says, Abba, do I have Down syndrome? She doesn't. What do those two stories manifest or represent? Elisheva, my oldest daughter, had to think out of the box, right? She was threatened for a minute with difference. And instead of thinking in the box of pushing difference aside, like so many people did, because it's hard to deal with difference, isn't it? She thought out of the box, she thought outside of the categories and embraced Shmuel. What about Avital? The second, sweet. She's adorably sweet, right? So for her, it's like, you know, he's my brother, right? All she saw was, I won't say, and it's interesting, I have a 2.5-year-old son who's very precocious, and I'm wondering what, somebody could do a study in my house, I'm sure, to what extent he realizes that Shmuel is different. But I think I'll be getting back to Avital, my middle daughter. It's not that he's my brother and therefore he's the same as all of my other siblings, but rather it's through his difference as Shmuel that I see that he's the same. Kiss him, embrace him, hug him. It's sometimes children that have the ability to think outside of categories. One of the wonderful things, I think, and Rabbi Kelman, you probably can attest to this, is when you have a special child in a home, it changes the whole dynamics of the house. You were saying culturally that happens. It's happening less quickly in Eretz Yisrael. Happens first in the home, happens in our building. Kids in the building are, you know, we have a gun. My son is being mainstreamed at a gun. So at parents' night, of course, there was some mother who came in and said, we don't want the child with Down syndrome in our gun. And the Ganemet said, you're lucky he's here. And the truth is, they are lucky because the kids are exposed to difference and dealing with difference. So those stories really, aside from being cute, I think, just thematize issues of sight and being able to handle difference, to see what a person needs. You know, there's a famous Rabbeinu Yonah that makes a distinction between chesed and tzedakah. What's tzedakah? Tzedakah is good, right? Tzedakah is you write a check. I lived in Los Angeles for a while, and the rabbi said, when somebody comes to your door, you take out your checkbook, you write a check for $18. Don't do that in Israel, right? It's not $18. That's tzedakah. What about chesed? How is chesed different than tzedakah? Well, it might be. It depends on... Tzedakah, I mean, tzedakah can also come from the heart. Uh-huh. Well, why is chesed... Why is the prerequisite for chesed that it comes from the heart? Why? So, interesting. Rabbeinu Yonah suggested that the distinguishing characteristic of chesed is that I first have to see the person. What does he need? Right? There's a pasuk, we don't have to look at it right now. Rashi learns out that you have to give a person what he needs. If it's a rich person, he may need a carriage. A poor person might need a sandwich. In our days, you might say, this guy, Nebuch, I've got to buy him a Mercedes-Benz. That's what he needs. Right? It may be low on my list of chesed opportunities. And there may be things that are higher on my list. But nonetheless, when I look and I see what does this person need, that's what he needs. Chesed entails, again, as we were saying before, there's a chiyuv to open your eyes. That's the prerequisite of chesed. Maybe that's how you give of your heart as well. When I see, then I can give of myself. I'd like to wrap things up or conclude today by looking at a long medrash from Tanis. This is on the bottom of your page 3. Yeah. So we'll just do the English, yeah? The rabbis taught in a braisa. A person should always be soft like a reed, and not hard like a cedar. There was an incident in which Rav Elazar ben Shimon was coming from Migdal Gedor, from his teacher's house. He was riding on a donkey and traveling along a riverbank, and he was feeling very content with himself because he had learned much Torah. Very content. This is a translation, obviously. I'm not so sure it's a good one. He was very content. Anybody find the Hebrew there? Pardon? Simcha gadol of ahaisa daito gasa olav. See, the translation's cleaned it up a little bit. I think it might be Art Scroll, yeah? Vahaitu dato gasa olav. What does that mean? He was slightly proud, I think. There's a slight connotation, not only of contentedness, but of a contentedness that is bordering on pride and perhaps even arrogance. Why was he feeling proud and arrogant? Why? He was at his Rebbe's house. He said over a shtickle, he said a vort, the Rebbe said shakach. He feels good about himself. So good that we see that the Gemara characterizes him as verging on arrogance. How does that manifest itself? Let's continue. He was riding on a donkey and traveling along a riverbank. And he was feeling very content with himself because he had learned much Torah. He chanced upon a man who was exceedingly ugly. The Medrash says, the Gadata says, Nizdamen lo Adam. He chanced upon a man. The man said to him, "Peace be unto you, Rebbe. Shalom Aleichem, Rebbe." But Rebbe Elazar did not respond and replied instead, "Empty one, are all the people of your city perhaps as ugly as you are?" Whoa, where does that come from? I mean, this is a story about a Tana, person of great learning and also holiness. Are all the people of your city perhaps as ugly as you? It's a major league diss, no? The man replied, "I do not know. But go and tell the craftsman who made me, how ugly is that vessel that you made? He may be ugly, but he's smart, right?" What is he telling him? Right? Go tell the craftsman that made me, i.e., go tell God who made me how ugly I am. You don't like his handiwork? Go complain to the maker, to the manufacturer. When Rav Elazar realized that he had transgressed, we see a tzaddik, he may fall, but he also gets up. When Rav Elazar realized that he had transgressed, he got down from his donkey, prostrated himself, and said, "I have spoken out of turn to you. Forgive me." The man answered, "I will not forgive you until you go to the craftsman who made me and tell him how ugly is this vessel that you made." Persistent he is. Rav Elazar traveled with him until he reached his city. The people of the city came out to greet Rav Elazar. Celebrity, the Tana has come. And they said to him, "Shalom Aleichem, Rebbe, Shalom Aleichem, Rebbe, Rebbe." The man who accompanied him said to them, "Who are you calling teacher?" They responded, "We are addressing the man who is traveling behind you. We know him." He said to them, "If this man is a teacher, may there not be many like him in Israel." Well, pretty hardcore, right? They said to him, "Why?" He recounted what had happened. They said to him, "Even so, forgive him, because he is a man of great Torah." He said to them, "For your sakes, I forgive him, provided he does not make a habit of such behavior." Interesting. Maybe we'll come back to that in a second. Rav Elazar immediately entered the house and expounded. He runs to the Beis Medrash and he darshans. He runs to the Beis Medrash, he gives a sermon. He gives a homiletic explanation. A person should always be soft like a reed and not hard like a cedar. And it was for this reason that the reed merited to have pens drawn from it to write Torah scrolls, tefillin, and mezuzahs. What is the nature of this experience? It's a very important Rashi before we address that question. Nizdamen lo adam. He happened upon a man. Yesh svarim shekosev behen Eliyahu Anavi zachor letov. There are those people who say the story gets told differently. This wasn't any stam man. This was a person, any ugly man. Rather, who was it? Eliyahu Anavi. And why did he come? V'hu niskaven lehochicho shelo yargil bedavar. Why did Eliyahu Navi come to Rav Elazar ben Shimon? He came to test him such that he would not become ragil bedavar. What does that mean, ragil bedavar? He shouldn't become habituated to the action. We see that notion of habit gets, maybe Rashi is getting it from the story itself. The story itself emphasizes, let him not become habituated to it. Let him not make it a habit. What is the nature of the transgression of Rav Elazar? What went wrong? Is there a relationship between what gets emphasized here? Two questions. Is there a relationship between his transgression and habit? And what kind of habits are we talking about? And further, what is the nature of this strange drush at the end that he says, and it was for this reason that the reed merited to have pens drawn from it to write Torah scrolls, to fill in and mezuzahs. Ma kesher, how is that connected? How is that related? What is the transgression of Rav Elazar? First question. Pardon? I'm sorry? Insensitivity. What was that sensitivity a function of? Yes? Ignorance. It's a Tana. How can we say the Tana was ignorant? Not seeing. Why wasn't he seeing properly? Again, yes? So presumably Rav Elazar is, again, he's an educated person. He's a Tana. Again, that makes the kasha all the more strong. Why would he see improperly? If we could just, again, and what about habit? Is there a relationship between this and habit? Everybody has bad habits. Bite your nails, scratch your head too much. Are there habits? Yes. So there are habits perhaps of cognition as well. That we have cognitive apparatus of how we see the world. And sometimes we get lazy. We become ragil. We don't see things as we should. Instead of seeing things as they are, we project our own versions of the world onto them. Why do we do that? Easier. We're lazy. The world is calling out for us, see. And what happens? It gets assimilated into our cognitive mechanisms. The bad habits of pushing difference away, of not seeing properly. Pardon? So that arrogance or self-importance sometimes prevents us from seeing what's in front of us. Again, that opening of the self to the other, which is really the prerequisite for chesed, yes. So perhaps it's that self-centeredness, as you point out, that makes him unable to see. Now, what about that strange drush at the end? And for this reason, the reed merited to have pens drawn from it to write Torah scrolls. What is the nature of this halachic drush? Yes. Yeah. So that's an interesting word. So maybe Rav Elazar should have been more flexible. Now, on the one hand, I asked rhetorically at the beginning of the talk, we know the Torah gives us very clear categories, a blueprint to apply to reality. It does, and we need to apply that blueprint. But having said that, that blueprint always has to be applied with flexibility. I have to be malleable. I have to be able to see things and to incorporate things differently. Yes, it's true the Torah gives us categories with which to view the world, and we need to use those categories. But the question is, when do I apply them? How do I apply them? That requires sensitivity. That's what Rav Elazar ben Shimon lacked when he encountered the ugly man and only saw, as you said, chetzonius, the outside. He didn't refine his cognitive mechanisms enough to see the inside. Now, do we see? Are we training ourselves to see outside, inside? Are we better? Are our cognitive mechanisms as well attuned, better attuned than Rav Elazar ben Shimon? You know, I was feeling very good about myself. I had given a version of this talk, and somebody came up to me afterwards, and he said he was a very distraught father. And he said, I have my own son, and you're so together, and how did, you know, what was the change? What was the epiphany? And I must have told him maybe one of the stories that I told you about my daughter Elishev or Avital. And as I said, I felt very good about myself. I was walking in Bayit Vegan on Shabbos, and my wife and I came across somebody pushing a carriage, and it had one of those tents on top of it. And the father was fiddling very nervous with the device. Nebuch, a poor kid, like 2-year-old, you know, little kid, in this breathing device. So I turned to my wife and I said, that's so sad. And my wife looked at me with just such reproach and said, don't you see how much he loves his kid? Right? The problem is a person who thinks, I'll quote Milton, a person who thinks that you've got to a certain point, once you get there, what point are you at? Ragil bedavar. Once you think, now I see. Once you stop asking yourself, am I seeing clearly? Are my eyes opening? Are my eyes opened? You become ragil. You become like the Tanner of Elazar ben Shimon, who so caught up in himself, couldn't see the other. Just to end, the question that we started with. The birth of a child with Down syndrome, a special child. Din or Rachamim? Which one is it? Pardon? Oh, thank you. There's a famous, Rav Shlomo Carlebach says, he sings, I've never heard him sing it, but I've been told this, that in the Shira Malas, he says, Hazorim, the person who plants Bedima Barina Yiksaru. The way people learn it is, or we say it normally, a person who plants with tears will reap in joy. So Rav Shlomo learns it different. Hazorim Bedima Barina. A person is always doing the same things together. Life is not so all the time categorically clear. Is my son Shmuel a manifestation of Din? You take him to occupational therapy every day, right? There is an aspect of Din. Let me talk to my wife. We can discuss that. Maybe, perhaps. My own experience tells me that the categories, which is not authoritative for everyone, but the categories that we use sometimes belie or betray our experience. In all of life, there's rachamim and din. How special are special children? Is Shmuel that special? I would suggest that they're really, you know, maybe all of you came to hear a shiur on special ed. This is a shiur about all of our kids. None of them fit into our categories. My wife and I know all the secrets of the neighborhood. The kid who's the queen of the class has a learning disability. The kid down the block who's the most popular kid in class is dyslexic. We're not Esav. We don't live in a world of perfection. We live in a world of complexity. So looking at a child like Shmuel also gives us the opportunity, it's a kind of window, into a continuum of difference. To see things don't necessarily fit our categories. And when we abandon our categories, or we allow them to be flexible, and we're not ragil bedavar, then we have the opportunity of seeing. Thanks.